I welcome you to the Nevada Court of Appeals. This is the very first argument in front of the Court of Appeals in the Carson City courtroom. We're in the Nevada Supreme Court building here, and it certainly feels different for me. I argued many cases right where Mr. Cornell is standing at the moment, and up here we have a whole different view of it. I'm very happy to be joined by my two colleagues, Judge Jerome Tao to my left and Judge Abby Silver to my right. I know they're very happy to be here too. And we will talk to counsel after the argument. And if you want to memorialize this event, we'll do that too. So we picked a case that we thought was significant. It had a lot of issues in it for our first argument. There won't be time probably to talk about all the issues, and so that's why when we sent out the order setting argument, we tried to narrow it. That doesn't mean if you have important points on other issues, you can't bring them up. But we found from our experience at our first oral arguments in in Las Vegas, that that counsel that tried to talk about all the issues never got there. So it's always best to focus on the issues that are most important. Okay, so the case that we are hearing this afternoon is number 64881, Cassinelli versus State. And Mr. Cornell, I see that you're going to be arguing for Mr. Cassinelli. Do you want to introduce your co-counsel too?
Thank you. It's my pleasure. John Oakes is my co-counsel. He was trial counsel for Mr. Cassinelli.
Okay. Oh, by the way, we're just judges, not justices. There's a clear line of distinction between the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. All right.
That's good to know. Thank you.
Do either one of you want to make any introductory comments before we start the clock?
No, other than welcome here, and thank you for sharing this historic moment with us.
Yes, thank you. And it's a great honor to be here and share this with you.
Right, and we also have some of our staff here in the audience, too. And Judge James Wilson from Carson City is also here to witness this event. So thank you for coming today. You didn't see him, did you?
I don't have my distance glasses on right now. Is that you, Jim? Hi. Everybody's blurry out there right now.
Didn't recognize him without the robe, right?
All right, so Mr. Cornell, you may proceed with the argument.
Thank you very much. My name is Richard Cornell. I represent the appellant, Dominic Cassinelli. As I see it, this case involves a question of first impression regarding the meaning of NRS 458.300, sub 1, when the parties enter into a fictitious plea agreement. And that's what I want to focus on. This case arises out of one of the most unusual plea agreements I've seen in my career, but we have to understand the competing dynamics on why this plea agreement occurred. My client, Dominic Cassinelli, and his live-in significant other, and with whom they had children, Sharon Hansen, had, I guess what you would describe as a BDSM relationship, which is to say they had a sexual relationship marked by bondage, domination, sadism, and masochism. When they broke up, and when my client found another girlfriend, Ms. Hansen filed sexual assault charges. Now, that created a lot of stress on both sides, particularly after an incredibly lengthy preliminary hearing of something like 4 or 5 days. From the state's dilemma was this. This fact pattern would seem to suggest that this was consensual sexual contact, and the timing of the charges seemed awfully suspicious. The defense dilemma, though, is where this case happened. It happened in Pershing County. I know for a fact, having represented Sanjeev Davishwar a few years ago, that Pershing County is where a jury convicted somebody for sexual assault at Burning Man. So the case would be tried in Pershing County, not a good place to try this case from the defense perspective. And if he's convicted of sexual assault, the sentencing consequences are horrendous. So the parties entered into what I would say is really a pretty creative plea agreement, and it went this way. My client was to plead no contest, per Alford, to NRS 207.190 coercion with no NRS 207.193 sexual motivation finding and no objection to 458 treatment if he qualified. Secondly, though, he was also to plead to a gross misdemeanor of dissuading a witness. He also, by the way, was to plead to a misdemeanor domestic battery in justice court. Now, to be said about this plea agreement that are noteworthy. Number one, the agreement on 458 treatment was only as to the felony, not as to the gross. The intent of the parties, particularly the state, was to make sure that Mr. Cassinelli got stuck with a criminal history, at least of a gross misdemeanor. However, because he was originally charged with sexual assault, he'd been in jail for 9 months because he had a bail on him that he couldn't meet. With 9 months in on the gross misdemeanor, that would have been conviction in time served per Anglin and Haney and the statutes construed by the Supreme Court in Anglin and Haney. Secondly, these charges both were fictitious as to the facts of the case. The original charges were sexual assault. Thirdly, I have no doubt, the inference is irresistible from the record, that when the parties entered into this agreement, they read NRS 458.300 to mean that it was the crime of conviction that determined eligibility, and there's nothing in 458.300 sub 1 that disenables somebody convicted of NRS 207.190 from receiving 458 treatment.
Why was that phrase included then in the plea agreement, if eligible?
Well, if eligible, I think reasonably means factually you have to present a certification from a certified drug and alcohol counselor that A, the person is an alcoholic, and B, would benefit from treatment. Generally that happens, as you know, but it's not necessarily a guarantee. Fourthly, and significantly, and you see this at appendix pages 110 and 111, Judge Wagner declared that he was eligible for 458 treatment. And fifthly, if that is wrong, as Judge Wagner later said on his hearing, his order after remand, if that's wrong, if he wasn't eligible, then under the circumstances, the appellant would have a strong case for entry of an involuntary plea for the authorities that I cited in the reply, because he relied on the fact that he would be eligible in entering into this plea agreement from his perspective. The problems then happen at sentencing. Ms. Hansen gets up and presents an emotional, one-sided victim impact statement. When trial counsel hears this and realizes that she's testified contrarily to what she testified to at the prelim in certain respects, he objects and asks for continuance.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you've raised this in the appeal, but there's quite a long dialogue between defense counsel and Judge Wagner regarding what he should consider as far as evidence for the combined hearing. And in fact, that's when the continuance was brought up, to get maybe the preliminary hearing transcript. All that was mentioned by the DA was, well, we'll just accept your representation. So the continuance was more, wasn't it more in the context of the defense's rendition of what occurred in the crime? And then secondly, in the beginning of the proceedings at sentencing, when you moved to go forward at sentencing, this victim impact statement was attached to the PSI. There was never an objection by the defense at the beginning or the commencement of the proceeding saying we object to this victim statement. And additionally, as the victim was testifying to specific instances, say the hunting of her out in the woods, there was never an objection during her victim impact statement at all.
Other than his objecting to want to get the transcript to show the judge that she was testifying contrarily to what she had testified to at the prelim, that would be true. That was the whole point of that issue, that if the judge was going to put reliance on his ultimate decision on the word of this victim, the judge should have had the full story. And they didn't have it. Why? Because they struck this deal in the middle of the prelim. They went in thinking that we're going to get 458 treatment, especially with the motion filed with the certification, and the gross is going to end up with time served.
But the request for continuance was really in regards to your rendition or the defense's version of the facts. It was never proffered to the district court judge that we object to the victim's statement or her victim impact testimony as relayed in the appeal.
The record says what it says. Was there a specific objection phrased exactly as you just put it? I don't think so. But you can reach the result that we hope you would reach without even reaching that issue, I might add, too. In any event, the second thing that happens is the state presents a Brenda Hughes to a friend of Ms. Hansen to testify to facts that or opinions that are very disparaging to the appellant. And I looked at this. If you look at page 9 of the appendix, paragraph 8, it says the state can present sentencing witnesses in support of the agreement. Well, if the idea is to stick Mr. Casinelli with a gross, and if the idea is that with all the time he spent on this gross, he's going to get time served inevitably, and if the idea is that he's going to get 458 treatment, how is presenting damaging character testimony, how does that support the agreement? Our position is it does not. Our position is...
I don't recall an objection, though, prior to her testifying at that hearing.
That's true, but in cases such as Sullivan and Statz and Klutz and Wolf and Stubbs, that's the kind of objection that the court will reach as a matter of plain error. Now, at the end of the day, with the testimony of Ms. Hughes and Ms. Hansen, Judge Wagner enters a 14-to-48-month sentence in the Department of Corrections, credits the time served against that sentence, and then a one-year in jail suspended sentence with 3 years probation. Now, I do want to say this. In terms of the illegal sentence issue, which was our last issue, at this point I'm not very bothered by that, to be honest with you, because at the time I raised it, I thought, you know, it's possible that between parole and probation he could do more than 5 years of supervised release. Now, it's not. The reason why is he didn't make his first parole board. So he's not going to do 5 years between parole and probation, so I'm not so concerned about that issue. The first issue, the meaning of 458 sub 300 sub 1, is the one I'm really concerned about. And as with statutory construction, the first thing we do is we look at the statute, and this is what it says. Subject to the provisions of NRS 458-290 to 458-350 inclusive, an alcoholic or a drug addict who has been convicted of a crime. Stop right there and focus on the words, convicted of a crime. What do we look at to determine eligibility? We look at the crime of conviction. I say, is eligible to elect to be assigned to the court to a program of treatment for the abuse of alcohol or drugs pursuant to the statute before he is sentenced. Okay, we look at what he pled to or what he was found guilty of before he was sentenced.
Well, let me ask this question, sir.
Yes.
This is where you're going with this. You're going to argue that the way the statute is written, that the crime itself, the charge itself, has to have a DV component, domestic violence component in it.
Right.
But if you look at the words of the statute, you know, the legislature is presumed to have carefully chosen the words that they used. In subsection 1, they say the crime is. They don't say that the conviction is one of these offenses. They say the crime is one of these offenses. And then in paragraph 2, they say an act. They don't say a conviction pursuant to NRS, you know, et cetera, under the domestic violence statute. So if that's not, if those are the words they use, shouldn't we presume that they meant, what they said and that they're not referring just to the conviction?
When they use the word convicted of a crime in one part, and then they use the word the crime or an act in another, I would say what we've got is an ambiguity at best. If that's what we have, if that's how you conclude, I would say the doctrine of lenity cuts in our favor. And I think it particularly should in this case when you look at what the Nevada Supreme Court has done.
Couldn't the intention of the legislature have been something as simple as this? If you're convicted of a crime that has nothing to do with domestic violence, you are qualified for this kind of treatment. But if you're one of those guys whose psychology is that you beat your wife or significant other, that's a different problem than alcohol, and we don't want you in the program. Couldn't that have been what the legislature intended?
It could have been what it could have been and probably was what the legislature intended. And if the charging document in this case had said,
that's what
coercion,
I want to ask you. Do they generally plead it, for example, battery constituting domestic violence with substantial bodily harm up in the north?
Yeah.
Do you see the constituting domestic violence within the information of the crimes, delineating the difference between a simple coercion or perhaps a sexually motivated coercion or a coercion constituting domestic violence, are these things that are pled in this county specifically by the district attorney's office, depending on how they want the consequence, I suppose, of the crime?
My answer is I can't speak for Pershing County. I can speak for Washoe, and the answer to your question, Judge Silver, is yes, in Washoe.
They do do that in Clark County as well.
They do it. And in this case, when you look at the charging document, page 1, it says nothing in there about the relation between Dominic Castanelli and Sharon Hansen, which is critical because that's one of the prima facie elements.
Let me ask you this.
Hold on a second. Did you see the time? We're cutting his time really short. Do you want to save anything for a rebuttal?
Well, I do, but I want to leave.
Well, there's one other critical question, though, and that is, even if you're correct, we have to go to the next phase, and did the judge abuse his discretion in denying their request for the 458 treatment?
And the answer is that if he has made a fundamental mistake of law, then the answer is yes. And that's exactly why we're here. We're saying he did make a fundamental mistake of law. We're saying that when the parties enter into a plea agreement like this that is fashioned in such a way to enable the defendant to get 458, we say that the judge cannot look behind what's in the pleading, what's in the document, and say, oh, no, this really is a case of domestic violence, so I'm not going to allow that, particularly when you have the involuntary plea angle.
We're not talking about subsection 300 now. That's the eligibility. So if you're correct on that and he was eligible and the judge was wrong, you still get to subsection 310 about whether he should receive a treatment.
Well, and my thought about that is we have an uncontested motion with a certified drug and alcohol counselor's certification. He is an alcoholic and he would benefit. To say that he's likely to be rehabilitated, you know, this is sort of like the psychologists back in the days of saying he's not a danger to health, safety, and morals of others if released on a lewdness case. No counselor or psychologist is ever going to say something like that because you don't know. You don't know until it goes through the treatment. But really, to say, well, I don't think he's going to be a good candidate because I don't like him or he isn't saying the right things now, that's contrary to what the Nevada Supreme Court said in Brinkley. The public policy behind 458, as fleshed out in Brinkley and Bunce and Adegile and cases like that, is if it appears that they're eligible, give them a chance. Why? Because so much of crime is alcohol and drug abuse related, and if we can solve the problem that way, that's a better way to go. Thank you.
Mr. Cornell, I misspoke. I said subsection 310. It's subsection 320 that has the discretionary language in it. I don't think we've finished our questions on that point, so you'll have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Shields, you heard there were questions asked about what the how the charging philosophy works and how the documents are actually styled. And, of course, with this statute referring to in 207-190 coercion and then 207-193 coercion that's sexually motivated, if you can address within your argument, would it need to be charged coercion that relates to domestic violence? There's no statute on it specifically, but could it be charged? Should it be charged? And if it wasn't charged, does that mean that there was no intent to exclude Mr. Castanelli from eligibility? All right, so you get some extra time because the clock's not running yet, and I already asked you a question.
Well, I won't start my argument until the clock starts, in fairness to
All right, go ahead.
Let me preface my comments by stating that it's my pleasure to be here. My name is Bryce Shields. I am the Pershing County District Attorney, and I'm representing respondent in this matter. Despite our different positions in this lawsuit, there are areas of common ground between appellant and respondent. To begin, respondent agrees with what appellant has represented in his pleadings, that NRS Chapter 458 is a valuable piece of legislation. It is designed to treat those who are alcoholics or drug addicts and
Let me ask you this.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. You mentioned in your response on the appeal that NRS 458-300, that the eligibility is to be interpreted by this court de novo. And yet you mentioned throughout your response that this district court had to make specific findings of whether or not this crime of coercion involved domestic violence. So wouldn't there be no ambiguity as to eligibility for this program had your office chosen to plead this to a coercion constituting domestic violence in your information as opposed to a simple coercion? And that way, the district court knows, everybody knows right off the bat that they're not eligible. By leaving that out of the pleading, and yet you're saying this is a de novo review, as a matter of law, we should see that this constitutes domestic violence, yet the only way to really see whether or not that charge constitutes domestic violence is to interpret the facts.
And let me add on to that, especially in a case like this where, granted that there may be disputes over whether a sexual assault occurred and all kind of stuff, but the one thing that's not disputed in this case seems to be the relationship between the victim and the defendant. If there's no dispute as to what that relationship is or was, why didn't you just add DV in there to the plea negotiation if you didn't want this person in the program?
I appreciate those questions. I don't feel that we need, when we're charging coercion, to specify that this constitutes an act of domestic violence. Because as defined by NRS 33.018, the use of force or the threat of force equates to an act of domestic violence. And so
the prosecutor changes their plea negotiations. They many times go from a battery DV to a simple battery, knowing that there's complete different consequences in the changing of that charge. And then everybody, including the court, understands what those consequences are based on that charging document.
I agree with that. But if you look at the way the coercion is worded in the NRS under Chapter 207, coercion is the use of force or the threat of force to compel somebody or to obligate somebody to refrain from doing something that they are legally that they legally have a right to do. In this case, the reason why we don't have to specify coercion with domestic battery or domestic violence is because NRS 33.018 already defines the use of force or the threat of force to compel somebody to refrain from doing an act they're legally that they legally can do is because it's the same thing.
Well, then why did you make the plea agreement if he's eligible, if you're so sure that this is domestic violence by the pleading?
Because
and that
the
court would know that.
At the time that we entered into the plea agreement, we did not think, neither myself nor trial counsel, and I can't speak for him, but we did not anticipate that this would be an issue as to his eligibility. We did not look at this coercion as being as constituting domestic battery. And frankly, I didn't look
it's right
at that
in
statute.
There. I'm it's sorry. Right in the statute. It's right in the DV right. statute.
If you look at the judge, the trial court judge, he missed it too. He didn't, when we were going to sentencing, he initially said, yes, Mr. Casanelli, you are legally eligible. However, under the discretion that I have under NRS 453-320, I am finding that you are not factually eligible.
So even he, Judge Wagner, didn't know that coercion involved domestic violence.
Well, he missed it. And both of the attorneys in this case missed it.
That was on the first time around.
Right.
On the remand, right. He changed his mind.
Correct. And after reading his order from remand, it changed the way that I look at the statute. And so now it's very apparent to me that coercion, as charged under 207, without even mentioning coercion with an element of domestic violence, it's the same thing. And I don't think that you really need to delineate that within the information.
Okay. Well, how about Mr. Cornell's argument that if there's an ambiguity, then the court has to interpret it. And he mentioned the rule of lenity, and it forces us into a different interpretation.
Well, I disagree as to whether there's an ambiguity in the statute. I think that it's very clear on its face. And when it's clear on its face, you don't go beyond the statute. If we look at subsection 1 specifically says, let me start all over. B basically, NRS 458-300 allows people who are convicted of a crime, addicts, alcoholics, they can apply for a diversion program unless they're convicted of some specifically enumerated offenses. The first category under subsection 1 are crimes against a person that are charged as a felony or gross misdemeanor under Chapter 200.
So let me ask you a question, Counselor. Let's flip the facts a little bit as a hypothetical. Let's say you have a case where you did charge someone with the crime of coercion, and in your charging document, you charge them with coercion constituting domestic violence. It's in there. It goes to trial. It goes to the jury comes up with a verdict that convicts them of coercion, but they don't find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of the domestic violence component. They just check out the coercion box. Do you think that at sentencing you could then argue to the judge, hey, this is a domestic violence offense anyway, even though the jury found that it wasn't for purposes of the treatment statute? Do you think that you could make that argument?
I don't think that we need to make the argument because coercion, as it's written in the statute under 207, use of force or the threat of force to compel somebody to refrain from performing an act that they're legally obligated to do is the same as it's defined in NRS 33.018. That's the definition of an act of domestic violence.
There's no doubt about that.
Right.
But still made a plea agreement where you said if you're eligible. So if you knew that, because you know domestic violence involves coercion, it's plain by the statute, then why would you make even the plea agreement if they're eligible? Because you would know right away as the prosecutor they're not eligible. Because so why even put that in the plea agreement?
That's the rub here, Judge Silver. As I mentioned before, neither myself as trial counsel nor trial counsel for Mr. Castanelli, anticipated that that would be a hang-up and that that would prevent him legally from being eligible and for electing a program of treatment under
Don't you think there'd be everybody would be on the same page if it was pled? Everybody would be on the same page if it was pled, though.
Yes.
Everybody.
Yes.
You wouldn't have missed it, the defense wouldn't have missed it, and Judge Wagner wouldn't have missed it the first time.
Correct. Which is why it makes...
You were surprised then.
I was surprised.
Right. Well, I'll answer Judge Tao's question for you. Coercion under 207-190 is the general coercion. 207-193 is the sexually motivated coercion, and it specifically says in subsection 3 that it must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and the motivation. And so under his scenario, if the jury came back and said no on that part of it, you'd be out of luck. And so then Judge Silver's point is, you can't then look at these other facts on the record, can you, and say it's domestic violence if the jury just determined that wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
But I see that as a different question, Judge Gibbons. I believe the Judge Tao asked whether we needed to include an element when we're charging conversion.
Here's the question. What's the difference between the jury acquitting him of the domestic violence variant and them not pleading to the domestic violence variant? What's the difference for purposes of the treatment statute?
I don't see that when we're charging coercion, we need to include that element or that variant of coercion with domestic violence. It's not contained in 207-193. If you look past that, coercion sexually motivated, that's a different animal. And we would have to plead that specifically, and there has to be a hearing to determine whether that coercion was sexually motivated. But it's coercion as it's written in the NRS, the use of force against somebody, and then as it's defined in NRS 33.018, an act of domestic violence is the use of force or the threat of force to compel somebody from taking an act that they're legally that they legally have a right to do.
So let me ask you this then. Let me see how far your argument goes. Let's flip it away from coercion. Let's make it a completely different crime. Let's say originally someone is charged with battery of substantial bodily harm constituting domestic violence. During the plea negotiation, everyone agrees to drop the DV component, and he just pleads to a battery constituting resulting in substantial bodily harm. Now at sentencing, they say we want to get in the treatment program. Do you think that you could then argue to the judge, nope, it was a DV-related offense?
Well, they wouldn't be eligible because that would be a felony under NRS.
Well, yeah, okay.
Violence.
But you know where I'm going with that. We can pick any. But you know, the question is, if in a different offense, as part of the negotiation, they specifically lop off the domestic violence language and they don't plead to it, your interpretation of the statute suggests to me that you think you could then at sentencing say, Judge, oh, the facts of this are domestic violence related. He's not eligible for the program.
I do.
Is that what you're saying?
I do, because the way that an act of domestic violence is defined in NRS 33.018 is battery. That constitutes an act of domestic violence.
Even though that's not what he pled to?
Correct. If, let's say, for example, that we had arson, we had charged arson, and someone was convicted of arson and they applied for diversion under 453-300. If there was not an element where that arson was not committed against someone that they had a relationship with, spouse, ex-spouse, person that they're related to by blood or marriage, then they would be eligible under 453-300. But if that crime were committed against someone that they lived with, a spouse and ex-spouse, then when you look at NRS 33.018, arson constitutes an act of domestic violence when it's committed against somebody against whom they have the requisite relationship with.
What if the appellant is right here and the court rules that Mr. Castanelli was eligible? What about the next part under subsection 320, and that's what Judge Wagner seemed to hang his hat on, that he didn't feel that he was a good candidate for a program and he wasn't likely to be rehabilitated. Are there sufficient facts in the record to support that conclusion, or is it something that sort of Mr. Cornell was suggesting sort of just has to go with it? Once you determine eligibility, you pretty much get it as long as you submit a report from a therapist that says you meet the criteria.
I believe that under the standard of review that this court is bound to, which is abuse of discretion, which basically means that this ruling is going to stand unless it's contrary to law or against reason or against evidence. Just looking at that, the court has to ask whether there was enough evidence to support his discretionary decision that he wasn't factually eligible. If you look at the PSI, and I'm sure all of you have, and you look at everything that's in the PSI related to domestic violence, sexual abuse, acts of violence committed in front of the children, and then you take the victim impact statement, which, by the way, was not objected to and was not cross-examined, and then you factor in the Aloha review that contained a note saying, John, trial counsel, let me know if you need changes, etc., which is enough to give anybody pause. Let me know if you need changes, etc., to this evaluation that you asked me to provide to your client so that he can get a diversion program. That's going to raise anybody's eyebrows, to say nothing of a judge like Judge Wagner, who has over 40 years of trial experience as a prosecuting attorney and a jurist. That's going to taint the evaluation, so to speak. But even without that note, there was ample evidence to support the finding that he would not be rehabilitated through a program of treatment, or that he was not otherwise a good candidate for rehabilitation. If we look at the allocution, not one time did appellant say, I want to change. I'm an alcoholic and I want to change. In his allocution, he specifically tried to blame others, tried to essentially maintain his innocence, which is fine, which is what an Alford plea is for, but he never expressed that desire to change, which I think that is kind of what Judge Wagner was looking for.
He also never really went into, as you said, anything about alcoholism or about how he would be rehabilitated from a program like this.
Correct. Judges, I believe that my time has almost expired.
All right, Mr. Shields, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Cornell, you have two additional minutes. I suggest you pick up where we just left off from the last argument. We didn't get enough time to cover that with you.
Thank you. In terms of 458.320, I would submit it's still a legal error. It's abuse of discretion to deny the man the opportunity for the program per Brinkley. Brinkley was the case from 1985 where they filed the 458 motion, and the guy in court said, I don't have a problem with alcohol, and Judge Reconzone said, fine, no program for you. And this court reversed because they noted that a lot of times with alcoholics, denial is a paramount factor that goes on, and that should not be a reason in of itself to deny a 458 program. And I would submit you have the same kind of dynamic going on here. If he gets in the program and he displays that kind of attitude to the certified drug abuse, drug and alcohol counselor, to where the person says, get out of here, you're not learning anything, we're done here. Then, on that report, the court can go ahead and sentence him. Likewise, if Judge Wagner had an honest-to-goodness hearing and said, State, I want you to evaluate this man and bring him with a separate person, and let me hear from that counselor, and that counselor had a different opinion than the Aloha counselor, and he relied on that counselor, then we'd have a different situation. Then we could say no abuse of discretion. But to say abuse, to say you're not good because I don't like you, I don't like your attitude, when we don't know how he's
going to do it. But doesn't a district court judge, at the end of the day, they can still look at the totality of everything and still decide that prison is perhaps the option?
But what did he really have in the end to justify that this person's not even worthy of a program? The problem is he was focusing on the facts of the case. And I mean, really, that was his primary focus, that I don't think you're factually eligible because the reality is you engaged in acts of domestic violence even though it wasn't pled. If I may make one thought, I know it's not kosher to talk about cases, but in taking Judge Tao's really excellent hypothetical example, you might want to take a look at United States versus Taylor from about 1993 and its progeny.
Did you say Tatum or Taylor?
That's the one that talks about
Taylor.
What does the reviewing court do to determine whether you're really an armed career criminal and the crimes of violence? And the answer is you look at what he was actually found guilty of, or what he actually pled, you know, what the judgment of conviction says, not what the underlying facts of the case are. And I think that's the appropriate approach for this issue as well. And I would leave you with the thought that if he is not factually eligible at the end of the day, this is an involuntary plea, and that's a problem as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cornell. Thank you to both attorneys for the excellent job. It's very helpful to the court to hear the further explanation and, of course, some of the factual points that were brought up that aren't always evident from reading the record. So this matter will stand submitted with the court. We'll take it under advisement for further deliberation. And so the very first session in the Court of Appeals of the State of Nevada in Carson City is now concluded. And